He crawled to his feet, shaking, staring down. The giant mouth was open, exposing ferocious incisor teeth that would have ripped him to pieces. The claws were longer than bear claws, longer than Mark's fingers. He swallowed again. Close this time. Really close. If the spear hadn't taken the animal directly in the heart, if the creature had had half a second longer, I would have been dead. Mark suddenly remembered the howling thing's victim and looked out across the clearing at the small tree. It was empty. Chapter 12. Mark followed the trail of blood until it disappeared. Then he continued to patiently search for signs. The few tracks he found resembled small human footprints except for the toes, which seemed to be connected. From what he had seen in the tree, with everything blurred and moving, the small being had two arms and legs. The face had been hidden, but he remembered seeing long dark hair. The heavy grass kept him from finding any more tracks, and the trail ended abruptly. The wounded quarry of the howling thing had vanished. "That's gratitude for you," Mark grumbled. He made his way back to the clearing. The howling thing lay as he had left it. It took some doing, but he finally managed to twist his spear out of the body. The arrow was another matter. It was wedged next to the backbone, and when he yanked on it, the tip broke off inside the creature. He studied the dead animal. It was incredible that he had survived the attack. The thing was huge and built to destroy whatever it pleased. A killing machine. Yet he had killed it. Elation filled him. A surge of something he could not define. A strange feeling of power. His chin went up. I saved a life today and didn't die. I'll make more arrows, better ones. And because of what I have, all the creatures in the forest will be afraid of me. He jumped to his feet and punched his fists in the air. He wanted to sing, to show what he had done, to tell of it. I am the killer of the ferocious howling thing, he chanted, stomping his feet in the dirt. I am the best. I am the killer of the terrible howling thing. He took his knife and sliced the long claws off all four of the animal's paws and began whooping and dancing around the bloody carcass until he ran out of breath. He would take the skin. He could use it for moccasins, a quiver, maybe clothing. He knelt and worked a full hour, peeling a rectangle of hide, about 4 feet by 3, that took in the back and the sides, leaving the skin on the legs, head, and feet. With the skin gone, the meat was exposed, and for the first time Mark thought of eating it. It seemed so dog-like. The thought of eating dog was not particularly appetizing, but he'd been eating bugs and worms and lizards, and the meat looked solid and dark. He cut strips to take back to camp to dry later. Everything he had been through had made him even hungrier. When he found his supplies, he opened a tree rock and drank the juice while he chewed on strips of lizard jerky. This place was not going to get the best of him. And if it was true that he might never find his way home, then he would make it anyway. He would become a better hunter and tracker, and his weapons would be the best he could make. Sooner or later, he would locate the arrow people. But even if he couldn't find them, he would be all right. He had killed the howling thing. Chapter 13. One tree rock after another slammed into his back.
Stop it, Willie. I don't want to play catch right now. Can't you see I have work to do?
Mark had studied the way the feathers had been inserted into the carved slits in the broken arrow shaft and copied it. He had found straight wood, a kind of cross between willow and cane, near the clear pool, and he used that for shafts. He still had no rocks or the tips,
so instead he had sharpened the ends of the shafts into needle points. There had been no scouting for 4 days. Mark had been too busy collecting bird feathers and finding just the right pieces of wood to form into arrows. When he wasn't making them, he was practicing shooting. In the evenings, after scavenging for food, he had painstakingly put together a vine necklace made with the claws of the howling thing. He never took it off. The meat had been stringy and tough, but not bad tasting, and he'd roasted it on a stick and eaten it until his stomach bulged. He was still hungry in some way, full but still preoccupied with food, and he thought of bringing down one of the buffalo beasts. Willie waddled over and crawled into his lap. Mark put down the arrow he was working on. All right. Maybe I have enough for now. I guess I have been kind of ignoring you lately. Come on. Let's me and you take a walk up to the pool. Mark patted his shoulder. This signal meant the monkey bear was to climb up on his back. Willie's long, furry arms clung to Mark's neck. Leaving the dark jungle always made the little guy nervous, and the only way he would agree to go was if Mark carried him. At the pool, they stopped for a cool drink. Mark stared at himself in the water. He was so different. His hair hung down to his shoulders, and his weapons and necklace made him look like an ancient warrior. The chunky kid who had begged to hike across the missile range hadn't really been in very good shape. But this kid, the one who stared up at him from the pool, was lean and tough. His forearms were thick and solid, corded with muscle. Now he could climb straight up any of the vines into the tops of the highest trees, and even hang by one arm while he collected tree rocks. His senses were tuned, and he was becoming a good hunter. The previous night's dinner was proof of that. He'd had his first taste of roasted screaming bird, taken with an arrow high in one of the trees. Mark watched Willie playing in the water on the other side of the pool. "How about going on a short scouting trip with me, boy? We won't go far. I'll have you back by supper. Promise." He patted his shoulder, and Willie ambled around the spring and easily jumped up on Mark's back. Mark walked for more than 3 miles in a direction he'd never had a chance to try before. The trees began to thin out, and the hazy yellow sky was clearly visible. He'd become so accustomed to the shade of the jungle that he had to squint to protect his eyes. The grass only grew in patches here, and for the first time he could see large areas of ground. It was a lot like the dirt on Earth, and he guessed that all planets were pretty much the same. What was it Carl Sagan had said? Oh yeah, we're all made out of star stuff, carbons and acids and stone and gas. Dirt was dirt, whatever the planet. He let it run through his fingers. The next day he would scout longer, take his bow and quiver of arrows and spear and see what lay beyond the forest. Maybe take Willie with him for company. See how this planet worked. Chapter 14. "Come on, I said I'd carry you. What's your problem?" Mark folded his arms and scowled at the monkey bear in the treehouse. Willie had climbed to the top branches and refused to be coaxed down. "You are such a baby." "Okay, fine." Mark picked up his weapons and food stores. "But don't say I didn't offer. You won't see me for a couple of days." Willie clicked and screamed and shook the branch hard. "What's with you? Do you know something about that part of the forest I don't?" The monkey bear continued to shake the tree and make irritating noises. Mark shrugged. "If you're worried about me, don't be. I killed the howling thing, remember? So just hold down the fort and I'll be back." He turned and walked across the meadow. Willie's clicking followed him until he was out of sight. Heading in the same general direction he had taken the day before, Mark hurried through the forest. When he reached the thinning trees, he slowed. There was not as much cover here, and he would be a target for some enemy, like a buffalo creature. He walked until late in the afternoon without stopping.
For reasons he couldn't explain, he was extremely anxious to see what lay beyond the trees. But food was a necessity. Finally, he stopped to eat. He wanted to sit in the warm dirt and enjoy the feel of it on his skin, but he knew better. It wasn't wise to stay out in the open. Instead, he chose a spot in the shadow of a tree and ate a quick snack of a tree rock and a piece of jerky made from the meat of the howling thing. A new sound came from overhead. Mark craned his neck and searched the leaves. A great bird with a round head like an owl was scolding him for using its tree. Mark's eyes narrowed. The feathers. They were the same red and black as the ones in the first arrow. The one made by the arrow people. Perhaps the people were close. He started out again. Walking was easy. The tangled bushes and underbrush had gradually disappeared, taken over almost completely by red sand. Dozens of large rabbit creatures, similar to the one in his meadow, jumped out ahead of him. They hopped on their hind legs like kangaroos and scurried into holes near the tree roots in the sand. Mark made a mental note of the new food source. By dark, he was wishing he had worked harder to figure out a way to carry water. The juice in the tree rocks was good, but he had been moving quickly and had worked up a powerful thirst for pure water. He would just have to wait. The day had ended before Mark was ready. He had hoped to find the edge of the forest by nightfall, but the trees, though sparse now, seemed to go on forever. Unless it rained or he found water, he would have to go back the next day. Food wasn't a problem. He could hunt, and he'd almost perfected starting a fire by hitting the back of his pocket knife against a rock he carried in his pocket. If he had the right tinder, sparks would fly into the dry leaves and start them blazing. After smoothing the sand under one of the scrawny trees, he lay down and rested on his elbows. He chuckled, remembering when building a fire with matches had been difficult, and without matches, impossible. His father had taken him camping several years ago, and they wound up spending the night huddled in cold sleeping bags because they had somehow let their matches get wet. Thinking of his dad made him feel guilty. It had been 5 days since he had tried to locate the blue light. He shrugged it off. Making the arrows was important. Eating was important. Living was important. His parents would understand. It was strange to be able to see the sky at night. Near the dark jungle, the only thing you could see when you looked up was trees. The black was overpowering here, and he realized that he missed seeing stars. He lay back and stared into the darkness. Maybe the stars were up there, but the ugly yellow haze was just hiding them. He closed his eyes and imagined stars. Chapter 15. It was early morning. They moved within 20 yards of where he was lying. His eyes were open, but he lay absolutely still, not wanting to give away his position. There were 5 of them, uncovered from the waist up, and obviously females. They were dressed in skins, and their black hair hung long and loose. They were carrying large pots and made no effort to be quiet. One of them laughed loudly at something another said. People, he thought. Planet people. Not so very different from Earth people. When they were safely past, Mark moved to his feet, gathered his supplies, and followed them carefully. They took a well-beaten path, which he probably would have missed if he'd given up and turned back that day. Mark darted from one tree to the next, trying to remain hidden. Soon a vaguely familiar sound reached his ears. Water. They walked to a small creek that wound its way through the sand and trees. Mark crept as close as he dared and watched. The girls had dark, olive-colored skin and small eyes with an extra fold of skin on the lids. They spoke a strange clicking language. One walked with a limp and didn't carry a pot. She knelt to drink from the trickling creek, and Mark could see the soles of her feet. They had a thick padding, and all her toes were joined by a web-like covering. When the pots were filled and the girls ready to go, Mark silently moved off the path. They passed right in front of him. Compared to him, they were small, standing only about as high as the middle of his chest. The girl with the limp was last. He got a good look at her injured leg. She had been severely wounded, and the torn flesh was just beginning to heal. Mark's eyes widened. The wound looked as if she had been raked with claws. She had to be the one in the tree when he had killed the howling thing. He wanted to step out and call to her, but was afraid he might startle them, so he held back. He trailed them through the scraggly trees and sand into another dense stand of forest. It would have been hard to track them in these woods, but someone had gone to a lot of trouble to hack out a wide path. The girls stopped to give their injured companion a chance to rest. She sat down on a stump in the middle of the path and waved them on. When they wouldn't go, she said something sharp in the clicking language and waved again. This time they picked up their pots and moved down the trail. Mark chewed his lip. He had to talk to this girl. But how? She wouldn't understand him. He waited, watching her, hoping to discover a clue. She was pretty in a strange way. Her skin was flawless, and except for her small eyes and flat, turned-up nose, she looked a lot like people from Earth. Mark made his decision. Quietly, he slipped out of the cover of the trees and stood on the trail in front of her. She jumped to her feet, her eyes wide with fright. "Mawuf! Tata Mawuf!" The girl was poised to run. Mark stepped back. "I won't hurt you. See?" He set down his weapons and held up his hands. "I want to be your friend." Her terrified eyes went to the claw necklace. "Kekone wate." "That's right." Mark touched the long claws. "I saved you. I killed the howling thing." Down the trail, they heard someone calling. "Lita? Wakta tuek?" "Is that your name?" Mark asked. "Lita?" The girl stared at him. She had relaxed, but still looked scared and confused. "Natunuk, Natunuk." She pointed into the forest, edged around him, and hurried down the trail. Mark hesitated. What should he do now? The girl had pointed into the trees. Why? What was she trying to tell him? He picked up his things. The trees could wait. Right now, he wanted to see where Lita and her friends were headed. There was no danger of losing them. The trail was wider than most of the bike paths back home. He let them get far ahead and started off. This area reminded him of his jungle, except it had more colors. The plants and trees were not as red, and the flowers had tinges of white, yellow, and orange. Eventually, sounds of voices and movement came from just beyond the trees. Mark crept closer, lay on his stomach, and watched in amazement. Before him, in a large clearing, was an entire village of huts made of sticks. Most were small and round, except for the long one in the middle. Some women were roasting meat over an open pit, and others were using sharp sticks to dig in a garden. Several children were running in and out, playing a game with a rock attached to a long vine. The men were carving with primitive stone tools, or sitting around the fire smoking. It was like a scene out of prehistoric times. The Arrow people wore the skins of animals Mark didn't recognize. There was nothing modern here. No metal tools or cooking utensils. Everything came from their surroundings and was fashioned by their own hands. The girls took the water pots inside one of the huts. Lita stayed outside and kept glancing nervously back toward the forest. An older woman spoke to her, and she reluctantly went into the hut. Mark waited a long time, but Lita didn't come out. Hunger gnawed at his stomach. He crawled back into the dense brush and sat down on his heels. Now that he knew where the Arrow people were, he could come back any time. And because the girls had shown him where the water was, he could stay in this area indefinitely.
First, he would eat. Then, he would plan how to meet the Arrow people. Chapter 16. The water from the creek tasted good, even better than the pool water. In the sandy forest, he had made a good shot at one of the rabbit creatures, and now he's preparing to roast it over a small fire. He decided the smartest thing to do would be to wait in the trees near the spot where he'd confronted Lita. Maybe she would be curious enough to come back and look for him. A twig snapped behind him. He reached for his spear and turned. There was nothing. Mark frowned. His ears must be playing tricks on him. Cautiously, he stepped behind the fire and waited. There was no other sound, no movement. After a few moments, he went back to his cooking. The green limb he was using as a skewer worked well enough, but he had to be careful not to get too close to the flame when he turned it. The juices from the sizzling meat dripped into the fire and made a wonderful smell. He quit turning the meat and reached behind him for a tree rock. His boot was gone. What the? Mark looked all around the fire. He could swear he'd had it a few minutes before. He turned the rabbit meat one more time and took it off the fire. Then he picked up his spear and walked down the trail a few yards. His stomach grumbled, so he decided to go ahead and eat and search for his boot later. But when he got back to his fire, the rabbit was gone. So were his bow and arrows. Lita. She'd pointed in this direction and caused him to come here. It had to be her. Angrily, he stomped out to the footpath. Lita? I know you're out there. Lita? Bring my stuff back. A tree rock dropped on his head. He looked up. There she was, sitting calmly on one of the branches, going through his things. Mark rubbed his head. That's not funny. He jumped and made a grab for her, and she climbed higher. Don't make me come up there. Mark started to climb. The strange girl dropped everything except the bow and quiver. She quickly inserted an arrow, pulled it tight, and pointed it right between his eyes. Now hold on. Mark put his hands in the air. You've got everything backwards. You're the thief here. I just want my stuff back. Her chin went up. Tso, kakone. What does that mean? Can I at least get my dinner? I'm starving. He edged toward the rabbit, which had landed a few feet away in a clump of grass. Nah. She shook her head and motioned for him to move away. Mark stopped. Look, this is stupid. If you're hungry, he rubbed his stomach, I'll give you some. He pointed at the rabbit meat, and then at her. She studied him a long moment and lowered the bow a few inches. Mark grabbed the rabbit, brushed off the grass, and walked back to the fire. He pretended he wasn't interested in her, added some sticks to the fire, and finished roasting the rabbit. She was quick. Even with her injured leg, she was able to climb out of the tree almost before he could blink. But she wouldn't come any closer. He continued to cook, and when the rabbit was done, he tore off a piece and offered it to her. She only stared. Suit yourself. Mark took out his knife and opened one of the tree rocks. She watched in fascination. He held out half to her. It looked as if she might take it, but then she stepped back. Mark stuffed himself, wiped his hands on his pants, and thought about what to do next. Lita seemed nervous. She kept looking over her shoulder. Mark was afraid she was about to leave. Jabbing his chest with his finger, he said, Mark. Then he pointed at her. Lita. He went through it again. Mark. Lita. It didn't seem to faze her. He tried a different tactic. This time he touched the claw necklace, growled, picked up his spear and stabbed the air. A small giggle escaped her lips. He put the spear down.
So you think I'm funny?
Well, at least that's something.
He sat back on his heels.
Okay, you talk to me.
She continued to stare at him with bright, shiny black eyes. Behind her there was movement. Mark jumped up, but before he could reach for his spear he was surrounded. Lita's tribesmen had their weapons trained on him. Mark glanced around. He had named them wrong. They were the arrow people, all right, but they also had clubs, blowguns, and primitive crossbows. A fierce-looking man with black dots tattooed across his forehead and a long, thin bone through his nose stepped in front of the fire. He looked angrily at Lita. Then he raised his club. It was the last thing Mark saw before he blacked out. Chapter 17. His forehead hurt, and his arm was swollen and sore from the sting of the blow dart. Mark held his head and sat up. He was sitting on a dirt floor inside a round hut. Whispers followed by peals of laughter came from the open door. Mark turned. Several small children were watching him. He stood up and hit his head on the ceiling. The children howled with laughter. "You guys are kind of short, aren't you?" Mark looked around the small room and spotted his gear lying near the wall. It was all there. His boot, compass, knife, spear, and bow and arrows. He scratched his head. None of this made sense. If he was a prisoner, why would they let him keep his weapons? An old woman with short gray hair and a stooped back entered carrying a large red leaf and a carved wooden bowl with a glob of steaming white mush in it. She put it down in front of him and knelt. "Quelconque que iti?" Mark looked at the mush. "You want me to eat that?" He raised his hand and mimed putting something in his mouth. The old woman nodded enthusiastically. "Quelconque que iti?" He squatted on his heels and picked up the leaf. "You wouldn't try to poison me, would you?" The woman gave him a wrinkled smile, revealing that all her front teeth were missing. Mark scooped up a small portion of the mush with a piece of leaf and tasted it. It was bland, but not awful. He took another bite. The woman and children continued to stare at him. Self-conscious, he hurriedly ate the rest, wiped his mouth, and handed the woman the bowl. "My compliments to the chef." She smiled again and backed out of the hut. Mark followed her to the door. There was no guard. The children were the only ones paying any attention to him. Everyone else was busy with their daily routine. He stepped outside. No one seemed to care. The youngsters circled him, poking his light skin and pointing at his strange toes and eyes. One little boy touched the bottom of Mark's faded blue jeans. An older child said something in the clicking language and pointed at the claw necklace. This impressed the others, and they lined up to get a better look. "You guys are lucky I don't charge admission." Mark sidestepped them and walked across the open compound. Two men who were busy decorating a rectangular shield with black and orange dye gave him a friendly nod. Mark nodded back. "Hi there, nice day." They looked at each other, shrugged, and went back to what they were doing. As he walked through the village, everyone acknowledged him politely, and no one made any effort to stop him. The fierce-looking man with the tattoo and the bone through his nose was sitting beside a small fire watching him. He gestured for Mark to come over and join him. The man took a long pull on the slender plant stalk he was smoking, and then handed it to Mark. Mark studied it. The smoldering thing was tightly wrapped with leaves and tied with vines. "My parents aren't going to like this," he muttered. He accepted the foul-smelling thing and took a short, polite puff. The aroma was so strong it made his eyes water. He coughed and handed it back. The man laughed and slapped Mark on the back. "Quelconque que iti?"
Catcon? Mark cocked his head. You people keep using that word. He put his hand on his chest. Are you calling me Catcon? The man slapped him harder. Catcon! Okay, sure, Catcon. Mark sat in silence, watching the activities around him. The women seemed to be working a lot harder than the men. He spotted Lita in the garden with the digging stick and waved to her. She looked away and kept hoeing. Mark turned to the man beside him. Are you the leader of these people? You know, the head? The one in charge? The man exploded with a barrage of words. His lecture lasted for several minutes, and Mark couldn't understand any of it. When the man was finished, Mark drew a picture in the sand with his finger of several small stick men. Above them, he drew a larger figure holding a club. Mark pointed at the figure, and then at the man. Is this you? There was another stream of words, and then the man jumped to his feet and hurried into one of the huts. In a few seconds, he came out and handed Mark his club. No, you don't understand. I don't want your weapon. I was just... Mark looked into the chief's eyes. He was staring at Mark expectantly, as if he was waiting for something in return. You've got this whole thing wrong. See, I really don't have much to trade. Why don't you just keep it? The chief continued to wait. Reluctantly, Mark stood and walked to the hut where he had left his things. He studied his small pile of belongings. The problem was he really needed everything he had. The compass. He didn't need that. Maybe it would be enough. He came out holding the broken instrument in his outstretched hand. At first, the little man just stared at the shiny object. Then Mark jiggled it, and the silver arrow in the middle changed directions. Ah! So, Catcon! The leader's eyes opened wide. He reached for the compass, holding it gently in his palm as if it was very precious. Excitedly, he called to the other men. Tisik Mak Catcon! The others crowded around and exclaimed over the treasure. Some good-naturedly hit Mark on the shoulder, apparently complimenting him on the trade. It's no big deal. Mark shifted. It was broken anyway. He caught Lita's eye and moved toward the garden. One of the younger men immediately stepped in front of him. Na! Yit si su Lita! Na! Look, pal, I just want to talk to her. She and I are old friends. Mark tried to move around him. The man quickly blocked his way and shoved him. Mark stood almost a head taller than the young man, and he thought about pushing back. He glanced around. Everyone in camp had stopped what they were doing to watch. Lita quit digging and gave Mark a stern look. Mark figured he must be breaking one of their customs. He stepped back. Okay, I don't want to offend anybody on my first day in town. The young man's face broke into a good-natured smile. Gat Catcon ni. He took Mark's arm and led him back to the men. Mark sat with them until it was almost dark, watching them shape and hone their weapons, smoke and talk. Mostly talk. They discussed something non-stop for more than an hour. Mark couldn't understand a word. At dark, the whole village lined up and moved into the long thatch-roofed hut in the center of the compound. The chief invited Mark inside and indicated where he was to sit. There was a fire in the middle of the windowless room, and the people sat in a wide circle around it, watching the smoke curl out a hole in the roof. The chief clapped his hands, and one of the men began pounding on a skin-covered wooden drum that made a dull sound like a bongo. Another man stood up and started moving in rhythm. Mark could tell he was supposed to be a bird flying in the air. The dancer was graceful and quick. He swooped down, as if capturing something on the ground, and flew off again. When he was finished, the chief took over and talked for a long time. The children must have heard the speech before, because they became restless and went to the back of the hut to play games. Catcon te sir tu se, Catcon, Mark jumped when he heard his new name. The chief was motioning for him to stand.
Me?
Mark's eyebrows went up. The chief pulled him to his feet and touched the long claws around his neck.
Dekon Tasir Nututu.
Oh, I get it. You want to know about the howling thing.
Okay, let's see.
Well, it's like this. One day I was out scouting, and I was just about to have lunch when I... Mark looked at their faces. The people were staring blankly. He scratched his head. I know, I'll do like the Birdman and act it out for you. Like I did for Lita. At the mention of her name, the group turned to look at her. Embarrassed, she covered her face. Everyone laughed. Here goes. Mark picked up his new club and started walking slowly around the circle, as if he was hunting. He stopped suddenly and held his hand to his ear. Then he crouched low and ran through the crowd until he came to Lita. He put the club down, dropped to all fours, and started growling and clawing at her. She giggled and tried to push him away. Stepping back a few feet, he pretended to shoot an arrow at the howling thing. Then he reached for the club and readied himself for the beast to attack. Here he decided it would be more impressive to alter the story a little. Instead of falling down when the howling thing rushed him, he stood his ground and stabbed the make-believe monster until it was dead. Then he put one foot on its head and raised his pretend spear in victory. The people all started talking at once. Apparently he was a hit. Mark bowed and sat down. The chief patted Mark on the head, then clapped his hands again, and the villagers stood and filtered out of the room, each one patting the top of Mark's head as they walked by. Mark didn't know what he was supposed to do. Lita hung back. When they were all gone, she pointed at him. Mark. Then she indicated herself. Lita.
Yes. Oh, yes, Mark grinned. He held out the weapon in his hand.
Club.
Kasa.
He jumped up and ran to the middle of the room.
Fire.
She followed.
Tisa.
We're talking. Mark grabbed her shoulders. Can you believe it? Lita and Mark are talking. Lita smiled shyly.
Talking.
Chapter 18.
Since no one told him any different, Mark decided to spend the night in the same hut where his belongings were stored. There were several other young men already lying on the dirt floor when he entered. Without complaining, they moved and made room for him. Mark lay down, but he couldn't sleep. So much had happened that it was hard to take it all in. One thing he knew, it felt good to be around other people, especially these people. They were so innocent and friendly. He assumed Lita must have come to his defense earlier when they had captured him. He couldn't wait to talk to her again. Maybe she knew something about the blue light. As usual, when he thought of the light, it brought back memories of what life had been like before. He'd been here a long time, almost a year or maybe more. Sleep finally came, but it felt as if he had just closed his eyes when the others in the hut began stirring. Someone was shaking him. He opened one eye. It was the same young man who had prevented him from talking to Lita in the garden the day before.
Kekon got no ma.
Mark crawled to his feet and followed the men outside. The women were already up. They had the fires going and were serving bowls of the hot mush. There was no talking. The men ate quickly and gathered their weapons. Mark finished his food and went to collect his spear and bow and arrows. If they were going on a hunting trip, he didn't want to be left out. Lita touched his shoulder. She had a worried look on her face.
Mark, say ditzik na, na.
She shook her head.
What? You don't want me to go?
Sorry, I have to. I can learn a lot from these guys. Besides, I don't want them to think I'm a sissy or something.
Lita stomped her foot.
Nah, Mark, nah.
Mark folded his arms.
Yes, Lita, yes.
She made an angry face and marched to the young man who had awakened him. They argued in a whisper for several minutes. Then she dragged him over to Mark.
Mark, Tuka.
Mark nodded at the man.
Tuka.
The young man seemed upset about something. He motioned for Mark to come with him. The two of them took their place at the end of the line and followed the rest of the men out of the village. Once they were in the forest, the group moved into a trot. Occasionally, a couple of the men would break off from the rest, then meet them farther down the trail. Mark would have liked time to study the new terrain, but every time he slowed, Tuka urged him to keep up. About noon, the group stopped to rest and eat. Mark was amazed at the number of birds they cooked. Somehow the two men who had kept leaving the group had managed to shoot enough along the way for every member to have plenty of food. They were allowed one drink from a skin bag containing water, and then they were on their way again. Tuka always stayed at the end of the line with Mark. It was obvious they weren't hunting for small game, because they passed up several good opportunities to kill rabbit creatures. Mark decided they must be after something big. At dusk, the men gathered around the chief, who held out a small skin pouch containing a tar-like substance. Each put his fingers in and smeared some of the mixture on his face. When Tuka was finished with his own face, he decorated Mark's. The tribe looked different now, more fierce and warlike. They walked silently through the forest for another half hour, until they came to a sandy clearing. Mark couldn't believe his eyes. It was another small village. He was excited. So there were other people on this planet. Some of them were bound to know about the light. Someday, when they understood each other better, maybe he could get Lita to come with him and talk to them about it. The men spread out and hid in the bushes until long after the sun went down. Then the chief raised his club. They stormed out of the trees and raced down into the village, yelling and screaming. Mark started to join them, but Tuka grabbed his arm roughly.
Gakona! Decide Lita! Sektu!
Mark wasn't quite sure what he said, except that he didn't seem to want him to go, and it had something to do with Lita. Tuka pointed at the bushes, indicating where Mark was to stay. He raised his club threateningly.
Sektu!
Okay, I'm not stupid. I can tell when I'm not wanted. Mark sat down in the sand. When Tuka was sure Mark wasn't going to follow him, he turned and ran into the village after the others. Still not sure exactly what they were up to, Mark moved to his knees so that he could see what was going on. The scene in front of him was chaos. The Arrow people were setting fire to the huts and running through the compound, overturning cooking pots and smashing things. Mark was stunned. He didn't understand. These were supposed to be the good guys. The same friendly, peaceful people who had practically adopted him the day before were now doing everything they could to destroy this village and the people in it. The men in the huts were taken by surprise, but they soon came out fighting. The Arrow people were ready. They fought one-on-one and drove the villagers back into the forest. Women and children ran screaming for their lives. The fire had reached almost every hut, and now it lit up the whole area like a giant bonfire. To his right, Mark saw Tuka fighting. Tuka tripped and went down. His spear flew out of his hand, and one of the villagers began beating him senseless with a heavy club. Mark jumped out of the bushes.
Stop! You're killing him!
The little man was frightened out of his wits when he saw the tall, light-skinned boy come charging out of the forest. He stumbled backward and ran off in the opposite direction. Mark dropped his club, grabbed Tuka's arms, and dragged him back into the brush. He shook the young warrior, but Tuka's eyes didn't open. The other Arrow people were coming back now. They were ecstatic because they had managed to chase off most of the villagers
and steal everything of value that hadn't been smashed to pieces. The chief raised his hand and was about to give the signal to withdraw when he spotted Mark trying to revive Tuca. He shouted orders, and two of the men hurriedly picked up the young man and carried him ahead of the others into the forest toward home. Chapter 19. Tuca was dead. The village had suspended work and spent the entire day preparing for his last rites. Mark stood in the shadows watching the funeral procession. Six men carried the lifeless body to a raised wooden platform that was decorated with flowers, vines, and leaves. They placed him on top along with his spear and shield. Tuca's family, which consisted of his sister, who turned out to be Lita, and an older woman, walked slowly to the beat of the drum, then covered Tuca's face with an animal skin. Someone handed the chief a burning torch, and he touched it to a small stack of firewood underneath the platform. Everyone stepped back to watch the body burn. Mark had made up his mind. He couldn't stay with these people. They were too different. They had wiped out a whole village as if it was a huge game. In the morning, he would go back to his treehouse and live alone in the dark jungle. He felt a hand on his shoulder. Lita had brought the old woman to him. Her sad eyes searched his face. Kekon estat mek Tuca. Tears ran down her wrinkled cheeks. I'm sorry, Mark said. A lump welled up in his throat. Your grandson seemed like a good man. Lita led her grandmother away, and when the fire had completely consumed the body, the people crowded into the long hut to talk about the raid, divide the booty, and console the family. Mark didn't go. He wished it wasn't so late. If he could, he would leave right now. None of this made any sense. The Arrow people hadn't really gained that much from looting the village. Just a few new weapons, some beads, and a small amount of food. Nothing they brought back seemed worth dying over. He went into the hut where he'd slept the night before and picked up his things. The hiking boot still contained one tree rock, a couple of pieces of jerky, an empty sock, and a few strips of cloth. He had replaced the shoestring with a vine, and now he tied the boot to his belt loop. At first light, he would be ready to go. Mark? Lita stood in the door. Mark didn't look up. He grabbed a spear and bow and arrows and brushed past her. His intention was to spend the night at the edge of the clearing and start back first thing in the morning. He would forget these people and their crazy customs and concentrate on finding the blue light. Lita followed him past the huts. He stopped and looked at her. Where do you think you're going? Lita? Mark? Talkin? There's nothing to talk about. Go back to your crazy people before they catch you out here and decide to kill me, too. Lita untied a string of wooden beads from around her neck and put them in his hand. She gave him a sad, confused look and turned to go. Wait. Mark caught her arm. He took off his broken watch and fastened it around her tiny wrist. Thanks for everything, Lita. Maybe I'll see you around sometime. She stroked the watch. Et te kus kakon, Mark. Yeah, same to you. He put the beads in his boot and walked to the edge of the clearing. When he reached the trees, he glanced back over his shoulder. She was gone. Chapter 20. The air smelled like smoke. It was still dark, too early for the women to be cooking. Mark's eyes snapped open. There was a heavy dark cloud hanging over the village. He crawled through the brush to get a better look. The meeting hut was on fire. His first thought was that the other tribe had come after them looking for revenge. But when he saw the attackers, he knew he was wrong.
These warriors were not simple village people.
They rode large, long-haired creatures that looked like a cross between a horse and a cow, and their weapons were made of metal.
The Arrow people didn't have a chance.
Those who tried to fight were cut down immediately.
Mark saw the chief and several of the men die fighting with primitive clubs against swords and axes. Some tried to run. They were chased and either stabbed by the mounted men or trampled by the mounts.
Mark scanned the grounds, frantically searching for Lita.
He ran into the clearing, calling her name.
A wild scream came from the garden area.
One of the men had her cornered and was bearing down on her with his mount.
No!
Mark started for her. A rope settled around his neck and dragged him back. He hit the ground hard. The rope was choking him. He fought and grabbed at it with both hands, but it was no use.
The man pulled Mark on his back through the sand to the center of the village clearing, where the invaders had rounded up several of the men, women, and children.
Mark loosened the rope and threw it off.
He stood and saw Lita being pushed roughly across the compound to join them.
When she spotted Mark, she ran to him and held on to his arm.
Es te suk, te suk.
The men surrounded them.
They were much larger than the Arrow people, and their skin was a light yellow, but they had the same odd eyes.
The leader, a fat man wearing a long cape made of hides, gave a command, and the warriors dismounted and began tying the Arrow people together.
Mark found himself at the front of the line, with Lita tied securely to his right wrist.
He could see that the Tusuk, as Lita called them, had not come to plunder the village for goods. They were after people, and now he was one of their prisoners.
The fat man was staring at him.
Mark stared back.
The man's eyes narrowed, and he yelled an order in a new language.
One of the warriors put the rope back around Mark's neck and held the other end in his hand as he climbed onto his beast.
The leader gave the command, and the men rode out of the village, dragging Mark and what was left of the Arrow people along behind them.
Part 2.
Chapter 21. It was feeding time. As usual, the Tusuk tossed a leftover hindquarter of raw meat in the dirt and scarcely waited until it was gone before they gave the order to move out again. The routine had been the same since the terrible day they had been captured. Tied together, the prisoners trudged along behind the riders all morning, and then in the afternoon the column stopped for a short break to eat and drink. Their numbers had dwindled from 25 to 12. The Tusuk did not tolerate weakness. Any of the captives who fell sick or lagged behind was immediately killed.
Lita gnawed on a piece of the raw meat.
She noticed Mark watching her and held it out to him.
Mark, eat.
Mark shook his head.
He and Lita were getting better at communicating. They spoke an odd combination of the clicking language and English.
He'd learned that the name she had called him frantically when he had first confronted her, Ma-Wolf, was a mythical creature the old people used to scare the little ones into behaving. His new name, Kakon, was more difficult for her to explain. She could only tell him that Akon was a very important warrior, and Ka meant the second or younger one. When he questioned her about the blue light, she claimed to know nothing. But Mark noticed that every time he brought it up, she seemed nervous and eager to change the subject. He was also picking up a few phrases from the Tusuk. Their language was easier than Lita's because he could hear distinct vowels. He understood when the leader, Dagon, gave orders to stop and go, or for his men to feed the prisoners or take care of the mounts.
Mark swallowed dryly as he watched Lita and the others gobble up the raw meat.
It wasn't that he wouldn't eat it. He often did when he couldn't find insects or edible plants along the trail. Sometimes he took a small portion just to keep himself from starving.
but it rankled him to be treated this way, and by now he was used to going without food. When he'd broken his ribs, he'd conditioned himself to eat only when it was absolutely necessary, so it wasn't hard to let the others have the meat. Dagon always watched Mark carefully. At feeding time, he would stand near him, staring openly, as if he was inspecting a novelty in a sideshow. It made Mark feel uneasy, though he understood he was different from the Arrow people, and that his skin was lighter, and he was taller than the Tusuk. Even his clothes were unusual. He'd outgrown his jeans and was now wearing pieces of them he'd wrapped around himself. Once Dagon pointed to the hiking boot Mark kept tied to his belt, and used the word Murkan. "Not Murkan," Mark said flatly. "I'm called Kekon." Dagon's second-in-command, a surly, bearded man called Sarbo, angrily drew his sword and threatened to drive it into Mark's chest for daring to speak to the leader. Dagon stopped him. That had been more than a week before. Now they were resting at the foot of the very mountains Mark had promised himself to visit some day. He only wished he had come here under different circumstances. Dagon was studying him again. Mark ignored the man and turned to Lita. "How long till we reach the land of the Tusuk?" Lita glanced up at the mountain. "Go over." She held up three fingers. "Tikas."
3 days? Mark chewed his lip.
"Then what?"
"Nakurstma."
She held up a wrist that was tied with rope. "Tusuk war to take workers." "I noticed your people weren't exactly against making war." Lita shrugged and took another bite. "Way much people." Dagon gave the order to break camp. The Arrow people quickly stood and formed a straight line. The men no longer put a rope around Mark's neck. Either they thought it would be too hard for him to escape while tied to the others, or they knew he would never be able to outrun their animals. The thought of escape had crossed Mark's mind more than once. The Tusuk had not bothered to check the contents of his boot, so he still had his pocket knife, which would easily cut through the rope. But so far he hadn't had a good chance to use it. By day, the Tusuk watched them carefully, and at night a guard was posted. As they climbed higher up the mountain, the terrain became rocky and the air difficult to breathe. The Arrow people were used to flat, humid land, and they were having a hard time keeping up with the animals. Lita cried out, and Mark felt an abrupt tug on the rope. He glanced back. Lita had stepped on a sharp rock and sliced the bottom of her foot. The riders immediately closed ranks. Lita bit her lip, looked straight ahead, and kept moving. Mark could see blood on the side of her foot.
"Is it bad?" he whispered.
"Bad, yes." Mark slowed the pace as much as he dared. Soon Lita was hobbling, and the line was barely moving. Sarbo stepped off his mount and drew his sword. Mark knew what was about to happen. The Tusuk would kill her, throw her body to the side, and go on without a second thought. The yellow-skinned man moved to the front of the line. He cut the ropes that connected Lita to Mark and the person behind her. Lita closed her eyes.
"Stop!"
Mark yelled in Tusuk. He stepped between her and the man. The executioner's eyes flashed. With his free hand, he shoved Mark out of the way and raised the sword. Mark gathered himself and charged. He rammed the warrior with his shoulder, knocking him off balance. Surprised, Sarbo stumbled and turned on him, swinging the heavy sword in a wide arc. Mark dropped to the ground, and the death blow missed him by inches. He rolled to the side and sprang to his feet, waiting for Sarbo's next move.
"Hoyat, Sarbo!"
Dagon commanded the warrior. Sarbo hesitated, his sword still raised. He gave Mark a contemptuous look, spat at his feet, and swaggered back to his mount. Mark looked up into Dagon's eyes. They were like cold black stones. He couldn't read any emotion. Why this man continued to spare his life was a mystery. Dagon ordered Mark back to the line.